Good morning. I'm speaking with Aaron Kirschenbaum, who is Code Pink's War is Not Green campaigner focused on climate justice and cross-movement solidarity. Their work covers Palestine solidarity, tenant rights, abolitionist organizing, and the connection between Zionism, anti-Zionism, and anti-Semitism in the context of social justice. Aaron's research on militarism and climate change has been published in outlets like Common Dreams, Counterpunch, and Hampton Institute, offering critical insights into the environmental and humanitarian impacts of global militarization. Today, we're talking about Code Pink's important War is Not Green campaign. Welcome to KABU, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, we rarely see environmental groups list warfare as a key factor in accelerating climate change. Why do you think environmental groups have unheeded the role of militarism in destroying the environment?
Yeah, no, that is a huge question and a really good one. But if it's all right, I might sort of start with just giving listeners a little bit of a picture into what the overlap of climate and militarism is to sort of then go into what is avoided. So, in terms of some of the history of Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign, I think it's helpful to sort of start with some of what's just very obvious to a lot of people, which is that war is killing the planet. The Code Pink started in around 2002 to oppose invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And during that work, we were in Iraq and Afghanistan and seeing a lot of the impacts. So, seeing birth defects, seeing farmers unable to grow crops, seeing the horrific destruction of cities, of infrastructure. And I don't think that it's a surprise to many people that this is the case. I mean, when you look at war, the images that I think most people see and that comes to mind for folks is giant clouds of smoke, of fires, of destruction of every piece of infrastructure. I mean, we're seeing that in Gaza right now with the genocide and the ecocide going on. But despite all of this, and I think the fact that environmental groups at that point weren't necessarily as invested in taking on war and the cost of war does speak a little bit to maybe the distance from folks that are at the front lines of confronting war and the war economy. But there also wasn't a ton of research. And then in around 2017, there was a book that some listeners might be familiar with called Drawdown, and it was talking about the most comprehensive plan ever to draw down emissions and carbon dioxide and confront the climate crisis. And war wasn't part of that. And so one of our co-founders, Jody Evans, spoke to him, and the takeaway was essentially that there wasn't any peer-reviewed studies saying that, despite it being a fairly obvious thing. And that conversation led to another one with Netta Crawford from the Cost of War project at Brown. And there were a few numbers that came out of that. One of that was that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, the US military, is the world's largest institutional polluter on the planet. If it were a country, it would be the 47th largest polluter. It emits over 51 million metric tons a year. The war on terror, quote unquote, which was, of course, oil driven between 2001 and 2017, emitted 1.2 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. And even that doesn't begin to capture the full scale of manufacturing, of contracted shipping, of infrastructure accidents, toxic waste dumps, contamination from our over 800 bases in 80 countries globally, and the operations of allied NATO countries that also buy arms. Or examples like the training exercises that we do in the Pacific, RIMPAC, which is one of the largest maritime training exercises in the world, which is US-led with multiple countries involved. So the more that you dig in and the more you unravel, it all becomes clearer and clearer. But there is just generally a huge lack of education. And this is sort of getting into, I think, why some groups have ignored this. Because just a few years ago at Glasgow at COP26, it was shortly after this report from Brown was published. And Jody and some other folks from Code Pink went there and was handing out stickers that said war is not green to people. And was asking, did you know that the Pentagon is the world's largest institutional polluter? And I don't know that that was necessarily surprising to everyone, considering I think just what people see with their own eyes, but it was a number that was very new to people and it was surprising definitely for a lot of people. And so to come back to your original question, I think the reason for this comes down to a few things. One is a lack of education. Another is philanthropic red lines, and another is political red lines. And when it comes to lack of education, this isn't a super known fact. In these organizations themselves, there have been cases where it's taken a lot of organizing and a lot of education to bring about some change. At the Sierra Club, they did organize trips to Israel for a long period of time through the Jewish National Fund, the JNF, which plants non-native pine trees throughout Palestine and bulldozes villages. It creates
Wow.
a lack of biodiversity. It's
Yeah,
a
that's quite surprising to hear the Sierra Club would be accepting trips
yeah.
to Israel. I mean, just clearly that kind of propaganda.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. And they have shut that down. There was a lot of internal organizing, but a lot of what it took internally from, we had a webinar with Hebe Ghassem from the Palestinian Institute for Climate Strategy, who was talking a little bit about her experience there, where she was learning some of this. And a big part of it was just genuinely a bit of a lack of education on it. But of course, then there is also the avenue of donors and philanthropic and political red lines. These organizations get a lot of donations. You know, you can point to just small case studies from groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which, I mean, for anyone following the news, Bill Gates is apparently changing his tone on this around confronting the climate crisis. But they donate a lot to a lot of these large climate organizations. But, you know, their investments are, they have 16 million in Boeing. They have 2 million in Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, L3Harris, all of these weapons manufacturers. And so when you start to confront the actual driving forces behind the war economy, you start to get into some of these investments. And but at the same time, also philanthropy also is built on a lot of very individually driven personal investments from wealthy donors that just have sort of their own pet projects or interests. And that's where a little bit more education and bringing this sort of elephant in the room to the forefront can help a little bit. And then just
Well,
lastly, in terms of political red lines, there are folks that just talk about the war economy or Pentagon spending. But once you start getting into the Pentagon, you start talking about the actual wars, you start getting into understanding the toll of genocide and ecocide in Palestine, of new Cold War, a new Cold War with China, of Ukraine, NATO. This can bring about, of course, attacks from groups like AIPAC or the ADL that attack the anti-war movement. And so there's definitely a lot of fear there. I mean, groups like the Climate Justice Alliance, Earth Justice, Greenpeace have also been attacked recently. And that, I think, happens not just for the sake of appeasing donors and other political allies, but also because of the way that anything that really gets in the way of the war economy is a threat. But still, I don't think that any of that is a reason to back down. We are all facing it, and ultimately, we don't have a choice but to confront what really is one of the greatest threats on the planet. And we have one of the strongest anti-war movements in generations. And so we are ultimately stronger together than we are siloed into these separate spaces. Cases.
well, that's a really helpful explanation, Aaron. And, it points to the importance of education and that, in order to educate, visibility and resources are key to movements and their ability to educate and affect policies. And as you pointed out, environmental groups receive a great deal more in philanthropic donations, something like I read $16 billion versus a very
Yeah.
tiny amount that the anti-war movement garners. So that, I think, explains a lot. But let's talk maybe just a bit more about some of the ways in which the Pentagon fuels the climate crisis. And you kind of provided some broad outlines, but maybe you could just dive in a bit to a key example, whether that's military bases or current wars in Gaza and Ukraine. I mean, can you outline just some of the ways in which these interventions and these expenditures really exacerbate climate change?
For sure. Yeah. Just thinking about what the current toll of the genocide in Gaza is, almost all of the vegetation in Gaza has been destroyed. It sits on a natural aquifer, which is where a lot of their water comes from, and a lot of that is through wells. And so when you have something like the toll of destruction, the rubble everywhere, smoke, the impacts of bombs and of bullets, of all the different sort of chemicals of warfare that have contaminated some of this, it starts to eliminate drinking water. It starts to eliminate ability for agriculture. And so it's going to, of course, take decades for any semblance of agriculture to come back and to be able to grow. And of course, I think in Gaza, ecocide, which is the total destruction of the natural environment, has been used as a tactic of warfare. there to starve the population. There have been instances where folks have tried to create seed banks to maintain levels of biodiversity. And similar to the assassinations of journalists in Gaza for telling the truth and for that as a method of survival and getting the world mobilized, folks that have tried to create seed banks have also been assassinated. So I think that's just a bit of a picture into what's happened with Gaza and the horrific toll. Emissions-wise, recent estimates have been that the destruction of Gaza has emitted more than 100 countries combined. The what it's going to take to rebuild Gaza if Israel stops breaking the ceasefire that it has continuously been breaking since it was instituted, what it will take to build Gaza will also be a huge burden. And so that's just one picture, the most recently. But of course, you also spoke to the over 800 military bases on the planet. And I mean, when you think about the reasons why the US is so invested in Israel's existence to begin with and why there is an ethnic cleansing campaign, it's to secure Israel's place in the region as a proxy state for continuing to secure oil and continuing to wage war across the region to uphold the oil industry. That's been a huge part of the US's support and why, despite sort of varying tones on the genocide from politicians in the US, there's still a refusal to go beyond it in terms of complete support for the Israeli project. And that's also why we have over 800 military bases in 80 countries that completely neglect any sense of sovereignty and any semblance of respect for the people there. Some of it is in strategic places. We have around 60 on the Korean Peninsula. There have been instances there where there have been jet fuel leakages. But because every one of these bases across the world is a piece of US territory, the countries, quote unquote, hosting these bases don't have any ability to clean it up. And so there have been jet fuel leakages that have stalled in cleanup in the Korean Peninsula for a long period of time because they're not able to actually access the base to do that cleaning. And that, of course, is devastating for local environments. And the 60 on the peninsula is essentially to create an unsinkable aircraft carrier, self-described by Pentagon officials, for increasing militarization in war with North Korea, with China. There have also been cases of leakages in one of the most well-known is in Red Hill in Hawaii, where in 2021, a jet fuel leakage poisoned 90,000 people's drinking water, and they have still yet to fully complete the cleanup and close the facility. There is known chemicals in all of these bases like PFAS, which is a carcinogen. There have been instances like in Vieques off the coast of Puerto Rico in the archipelago that was used as a bomb testing site for decades since the 50s until around 2003 after a mass protest movement evicted the base. But it was a bomb testing site and created in as of 2017, lung cancer and bronchitis was up to 280% more likely among women than the mainland of Puerto Rico and 200% more likely than men. There was 80 million pounds of munitions dropped and dozens of materials that have still made the land, despite it being a animal preserve now, unable to be used and still infects people to this day. And a lot of those bombs, of course, went on to be used in Palestine. And these connections, when the protest movement was happening, were really crystal clear. I think in all of these examples of places that are on the front lines of resisting militarism and ecocide, they understand those as a joint struggle and that it's the struggle for the land, is the struggle for sovereignty, is the struggle against US militarism, US imperialism. And in Vieques, you had fishers participating in these protests, religious leaders, independence organizers, statehood organizers, people from across the mainland US, from across the world, recognizing this as one of these joint struggles. And I think you see this in every single one of these because of just how abundantly clear this all is.
Yes. Well, let me interrupt here and just say this is Laurie Mercier for the Olmo Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Aaron Kirschenbaum, who is Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaigner. And Aaron, tell us more about the War Is Not Green campaign.
Yeah. So the campaign itself is a overarching campaign that has been present, as I was saying, since Code Pink's creation. And it really is addressing this longtime avoidance, silence, lack of education, lack of unity between what two movements that are considered separate, the environmental movement and the anti-war movement, but that really do have all of the same targets. And are going up against the same things. And so it's taken different forms and different moments, but it's essentially a way to grow movements towards seeing where we can support one another, seeing militarism as a joint enemy that we need to confront together. And so right now, what we've done a few things recently. One is our open letter called Environmentalists Unite, War Fuels the Climate Crisis, which collected a few thousand signatures from individuals and over 100 from various organizations, many of whom wouldn't necessarily have signed one of these letters a few years ago, but it encompasses environmental organizations, anti-war organizations, frontline organizations, and is very much so a bare minimum of just sort of acknowledging these relationships that war is one of the primary contributors to the climate crisis, that we can't avoid it, that what the genocide in Palestine has cost, what the war in Ukraine has cost, in what escalation in the Asia Pacific is doing, but it doesn't actually call for anything. And so it is sort of just this unifying factor to get to the first place that we're trying to get to, which is acknowledging the significance of the crisis. And a lot of organizations, it was incredible to see how many signed on, and it is a huge indicator of change. But some did not. And a lot of these organizations are some of the largest, wealthiest, most well-funded organizations in the country. And so we've launched a sort of new sub-campaign within War Is Not Green, which is the Elephant in the Room campaign. And that name comes from imagery that we've used for a while. We've brought big blow-up elephants to climate protests. We've had that imagery for a while, and it's to say that the cost of war and imperialism and militarism is the elephant in the room in climate spaces. And so we are inviting, not attacking, 12 of the largest and most influential, most well-funded organizations in the country: the Sierra Club, the Center for Biological Diversity, Earth Justice, Project Drawdown, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the National Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, the Environmental Defense Fund, the World Wildlife Fund, the Wilderness Society, Conservation International, and the Nature Conservancy. And
That's
together,
quite a list. And Aaron,
oh.
we'll link, I think, on the Code Pink website that you have at that list. And so we'll link to it on our website so that if there are listeners who belong to any of those groups, they can help pressure those groups to sign on to this pledge.
Absolutely. And together, they amount to an annual revenue of almost $4 billion, which is pretty wild. And we are starting with asks to the Sierra Club because it has almost 4 million members and a budget that is made up of a lot of the funds from those members. And a lot of groups in the Sierra Club are already actually engaging in some of this work, which is incredible to see. In Hawaii, they've been trying to resist the militarism that maintains and occupies the land. There are a lot of other groups doing a lot of other incredible stuff, but because of this, and because of sort of the shifts that have already taken place there, it's a strategic target to start out with. And not all of these organizations are the same. Not all of them are in the same place. Not all of them are going to be as movable or not. But it's a way to both invite and educate their membership, their leadership, philanthropy, get this into much more mainstream conversations that can't be avoided. And we might bring some of these organizations in and some of their members. And if we don't, that is also really clarifying to see what red lines exist, what don't, and why philanthropy and various organizations operate the way that they do. And so it's been great to see the progress that we've made and continuing to talk more with them.
Speaking of progress, you mentioned earlier the United Nations Climate Change Conference, I think COP26, when Medea Benjamin and other Code Pink activists launched this War Is Not Green campaign. What about the COP30 meeting now in Brazil? Will anyone there address the role of militarism?
Yeah, so the way I see it is there's sort of two parts of what COP is often. There is the official narratives and negotiations between countries, the various agreements, and then there's everyone else that's there, from climate movements, from local organizations, from big greens. And so it's sort of a hodgepodge of all of that. And so when it comes to the official conference itself, I and most organizers do not expect the cost of war's relationship to the climate crisis to be directly addressed in this. And this goes back years to the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, which was the precursor to the contemporary Paris Agreement. And the US government there lobbied to omit the military emissions in official counting of emissions globally. And this continued under the Paris Agreement in 2015. And now that is still the case, but the US government itself has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And so I don't expect it to be addressed in the main conference, but there will be a lot, I think, discussed that will be circling around the edges of talking about it. I mean, it's in Brazil, so there's going to be discussions around multilateralism, multipolarity. Brazil is part of the economic and political bloc. BRICS has discussed climate reparations. There's probably going to be a lot of discussions on the fact that the US isn't present and the various tariffs and trading agreements, the role of extracting of critical minerals, which is done and used for war, by war, with, the Pentagon's the largest shareholder of the largest company of for rare earth mining in the Western Hemisphere. And so it's in the Amazon as well, which makes a lot of hypocrisy clear. And with tons of trees being demolished for this, folks are coming into Belém on cruise ships. There was some discussion of that. And so there is going to be a lot of indigenous protesters, the landless peasant movement. There's a counter summit that is going to be bringing up all of this, where there is militarism, working groups, and various constituencies that are going to be hosting a lot of talks and bringing this to the forefront. And that is, I think, a shift from the past as well, how present it is, given, I think, just how unavoidable all of this keeps becoming. And so militarism, in the truest sense, is going to be brought about through the people that are there organizing, and from journalists that have brought it into conversation in the past. But the significance of COP is always, I think, what it can do for the broader grassroots climate movement, and maybe now what changing multipolarity can do in the world for this conversation as well.
It does seem like the anti-war movement, the anti-genocide movement of the last 2 years has really helped focus more on local and state investments, how we can, since the federal government seems to be immovable, not responding to the interests and the will of the 99%. I know here in Oregon, the Oregon for Human Rights Coalition is seeking to require the State Investment Council to use a human rights environmental screen when making investments. And in Portland, half the city councilors have signed a landmark pledge to investigate the manufacturing and transport of weapons to Israel, which represents a municipal approach to challenging U.S. complicity in Israel's ongoing occupation of Palestine. So there does seem to be movement towards, recognizing that the United States spends $1 trillion annually on death and destruction and how we might put those resources to more productive uses. So, Aaron, finally, how can listeners find out more about the Code Pink War Is Not Green campaign and join in this effort?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find out about the campaign overall by going to codepink.org/wing, WING. That's the acronym for it. We do have a bi-weekly working group, which you can go to and see at codepink.org/wing sign up. You can learn more about the actual campaigns that we're working on, like the Elephant in the Room campaign, by going to codepink.org/elephant and codepink.org/Sierra Club. And finally, we are also supporting Abby Martin and Mike Prisoner's Earth's Greatest Enemy film, which covers all of this and is a really incredible, harrowing, emotional, powerful documentary that definitely, I think, will teach a lot of people a lot. And, some Sierra Club chapters have signed on to it, and a lot of Sunrise Movement chapters. And so it's definitely an opportunity to do outreach. And we have some of the tools for that at codepink.org/EGE toolkit. And actually, for listeners in the Portland area, there is going to be two upcoming screenings in the area, and you can go with us to them and talk with fellow Code Pinkers and folks doing this work at them. One is on the 18th in Eugene, codepink.org/EGE Eugene, and one is in Portland on the 30th, codepink.org/EGE Portland. There also is a Portland Code Pink chapter on Instagram at CodePinkPDX. And you can also just follow our general social media accounts. There's the War Is Not Green ones, which is War Is Not Green on both Instagram and Twitter. Code Pink Alert on Instagram and Code Pink on Twitter, X, and most other social media platforms.
Great, Aaron. We'll provide the links on the Old Mole page on the KBOO website. And thanks again for joining us today. Thanks so
Thank you
much,
so
Aaron.
Much. Thank you for having me.
Thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train, take this country, come take me home again.